You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Create dangerously for people who read dangerously. This is what I've always thought it meant to be a writer. Writing, knowing in part that no matter how trivial your words may seem, someday, somewhere, someone may risk his or her life to read them. This is what I've always seen as the unifying principle among all writers. Somewhere, if not now, then maybe years in the future, a future we may have yet to dream of, someone may risk his or her life to read us. Somewhere, if not now, then maybe years in the future, we may also save someone's life because they have given us a passport, making us honorary citizens of their culture.
Welcome to Beyond the Page. I'm John Burnham Schwartz, literary director of the Sun Valley Writers Conference. From her very first novel, Breath, Eyes, Memory, published when she was 25 and chosen for Oprah's book club, Edwige Dantika has written with indelible honesty and empathy about how Haitian history and the Haitian diaspora have both shattered and strengthened families, her own and others, across generations. Edwige was born in Haiti in 1969. By the time she was four, both of her parents had emigrated to Brooklyn, leaving her in the care of her uncle Joseph. Edwige wouldn't join them there until she was 12. We begin this episode with Edwige Dantika talking to Jeffrey Brown, PBS NewsHour's senior correspondent, about how, at a young age, storytelling became her window to the outside world.
Take us back to that young girl growing up in Haiti. Where did the idea of storytelling even come from?
Well, my family was full of storytellers. I come from a modest background. My parents migrated, part because of the dictatorship, but also because they were poor and wanted better opportunities. But I was always surrounded by storytellers, and often there would be blackouts. Electricity would go out, and then if there was a gap, we would tell stories. The elders in my family, who were not literate, who didn't read, but they had a mind full of stories, and the stories were always animated. And the audience connection was so powerful that if the elder telling the story noticed that the kids were sleeping, suddenly there was a song, and we're all singing, and they're all suspenseful. But I think I was mostly attracted to them also because of all these stories. It's like every other kid's story had an absent parent. Mm-hmm. It's like the Disney story. I always tell my girls, oh my God, the mother just coughed. She's going to die. So my mother was away. And so the oral storytelling was the source. And I always tell people like my best teachers were oral storytellers. But I wasn't an animated child. I was very reserved. I was shy. So I would look at these storytellers. I said, I can't do that. I can't do the whole singing, jumping up and down. And then when I got my first book when I was four, which was Madeleine in a House in Paris that was covered with vines,
okay,
that my uncle Joseph, who John mentioned, gave me. It was my very first book. Yeah. It was in French. And I was like, oh, this little girl, it's kind of like the house where I was growing up in with my uncle and aunt. There were many children whose parents had migrated to New York and other places. And I thought, oh, this is this is a different kind of thing with story. You don't have to, it's a much more, it could be for a quiet person. Mm-hmm. And when I was reading that book, it's like, I want to do that, what that book is doing for me. I didn't know what it meant, like how you would get there, but that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to convey what I was feeling in that
experience. And that's the beginning of the desire to be a writer.
Yes, and I couldn't really define it. I didn't, you know, and then we read in school, we started reading French writers, and they were French, male, dead. And I was like, oh God, I hope I don't have to be French, male, dead to be a writer. And then, you know, when I started reading contemporary Haitian writers,
yeah,
and I came
but,
to the
but
U.S.
But when was that? I mean, when was your awareness that there was a Haitian writing, particularly in the context you started this, that there was a dictatorship, mm-hmm, and that to be a writer was a dangerous thing?
Well, I started reading Haitian writers in Brooklyn. My parents were finally, and the reason we were separated all those many years, because my parents, when they came to the U.S., were undocumented for a while, and then they got their papers, and it took 5 years after they got their papers to send for us. So when I was 12, our family was reunited, and I remember my dad taking me to the Brooklyn Public Library, the main branch, and we were looking for books in French, because I didn't read English, and then there was two shelves of books, because Livre Haïtien, there were books by Haitian writers. So I started reading Haitian writing in Brooklyn, and I started reading it as a way to go back. And then it seemed possible to be a writer, and then I started reading. I think the first book I read in English was Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Cage Bird Sings.
Oh, yeah?
And when I read that, just changed my whole life, because there were some very painful things in there that I thought, oh my gosh, she wrote this and she's walking around, she looks fabulous, mm-hmm, nobody's shaming her. It was just the intimacy of that, I felt like opened up this whole other world for me.
You know, when we first met, you told me that coming here at the age of 12 was like coming from one planet to another. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that feeling?
I do. And that's what it was like back then, because, well, now when I meet young people who have come from Haiti, they already know so much about the United States. And you're texting all the time, they're at the movies, but I didn't really have any idea what it was like. Mm-hmm. I knew it was cold, and everybody who had ever migrated to any part of the United States, everybody said it was New York. So New York was like the other, the place. And so I didn't know what to expect. Mm-hmm. And it was just really going from a very different reality into another one that was so uncertain that we didn't really know what to expect. And it was a very hard time in the 1981 for people who were Haitian in New York. The AIDS was just coming into the national conversation, and we were the only ones identified as a high-risk group by nationality. Mm-hmm. So it was really tough to be in school. It was like everything I knew about myself had changed in this space.
There's also your parents coming here first and leaving you behind, mm-hmm, right? And thinking about what that meant and what that took for them to make that journey and for them to leave you behind and how you felt.
Yeah. I had to revisit that whole side of my life again recently with watching what's happening with the children being separated from their parents, and I wrote a little bit about it. But I couldn't really remember my father leaving because I was two, but people would tell me stories about him, and I feel like every memory I have of my father at that age is a borrowed memory. And then when I was four, when my mom left, that's one of my first memories ever, is that. So my mom was a seamstress, and she was sewing furiously the days before she left, and she made me a bunch of clothes and sort of different sizes. And then the day she was leaving, we're all dressed up, we went to the airport, and I thought I was going. And so we get there, and, you know, I was literally pulled out of her arms. So, yeah, I didn't mean for that to happen. Yeah, and so, but when I was a teenager, I had a bit of a rebellion, I had watched too many after-school specials, where, and the young people won't know what that is, where the American kids demand privacy and so on. So I thought I could confront my parents, and I was like, why did you do that? Why did you leave me? And my mom said, you know, every time I ate, I wondered if you were eating. Every time I slept, I wondered if you were sleeping. And so finally, I got that. I understood the choice, and also becoming a parent makes me understand it a lot more.
In her award-winning memoir, Brother, I'm Dying, Edwige wrote powerfully about how her beloved Uncle Joseph, who essentially raised her, was forced to flee Haiti at the age of 81 after armed gangs ransacked his church and school. Joseph applied for political asylum in America, but once he arrived, he was held by U.S. Customs and neglected, though he was gravely ill. 5 days later, still in custody, he died, before Edwige or any of her family members could see him.
You know, in The Dew Breakers, which is the one of the early books, the one we talked about the first time we talked, you talk about exploring the ways, I think you put it, that we don't always choose what comes with us, right, in immigration. What's with us and what's left behind. And that tension has always been there for you in your writing. Talk a little bit about how that stays with you. What comes with you and what doesn't.
Well, even in my own departure, like when I was leaving, I was told very, like, okay, you're going to your parents. And then I thought to myself, because then my uncle used to have a joke when he was traveling, he would say, oh, I wish I could fit you in the suitcase with me. And then I thought, who am I going to fit in my suitcase when I leave? My friends, I was thinking. And then you started feeling the limitation of just like having that one bag or having two bags. So what you really bring with you are your memories. You don't really, although I don't even have any of the physical things I thought I brought with me, which was a book my uncle gave me and some other things I had. I don't think I have any of that anymore. But it's the memories. And I think one of the reasons I started writing was to recreate all of that, was to kind of recreate my version of this world that I felt would have slipped away. And the tension also extends to actual people, because we go back very often, and then you go back and you actually see people, young people who were very brilliant, who had so much possibility but didn't have the opportunities, and what their lives are like. So there's the thing of not just nostalgia, but actually visiting human beings who you've left behind and seeing how the track of your life and the track of their life, like if you had switched places, what that might have been like for them and for you. So it's more than feeling like you've left a home, but you've actually left people, you've left places.
In Create Dangerously, I think that's where I see you being writing more openly about yourself, about this tension of still being there, the homeland, and yet not being there, right?
It's something that I'm always processing. The right to tell the stories that I have. And I remember I was always amazed, like when I wrote Breath, Eyes, Memory, my mom sort of read, I don't think she read the whole thing, but she read some parts of it, and it has some sexual things in it. And one of the things she said was that, first thing she said, well, now people are gonna think you're not a good girl. And then the second thing was like, how did you know these things, right? And so, and I wasn't quite sure how I quite knew them, right? And so I wanted to, that's the processing all the time. Mm. And if you're writing also about a place like Haiti that is often so maligned, right? And you want to do it justice, you want to talk about the complexity of it, the beauty, the strength of the people, but you also want to be truthful. You don't want to join the tourism board, right? And so that's something that I'm always negotiating. But this, and writing for me is a lot of it is the way I process things, mm-hmm. right? And so these essays were sort of a way of processing
but,
that.
But the right to tell the story. Mm-hmm. Go back to that phrase you just used. Yeah. Who has the right to tell the story? How much can you say when you're not there anymore? How is it going to be seen back in Haiti? How is it going to be seen in the immigrant community in which you now live? That's difficult?
I think that's a tension that people who live outside tend to have. You know, when I published Breath Eyes Memory, it was often said, you know, I was a Haitian writer in America. I was an American writer in Haiti. Uh-huh. So, and the fact that the book was in English, there was always those tensions, like where do you fit? And I remember reading an essay by Julia Alvarez where she talks about just living on that hyphen, right? And the hyphen is the island. And that sort of opened that to me, like sort of like this is the home, is the hyphen, and you have to sort of like every story is mine, but not every story is mine at the same time. Mm-hmm. And when I'm writing nonfiction, it's a more direct encounter where if people in my life say, I don't want you to write about me, and after I've said the 100th time, can I just change your name? And they still say no, then I have to respect that. So that's also negotiating that on the same level, but still feeling free, right? Because I feel like as an artist, this is the freest space we have, right? This is the space where you can be free and you can worry about being censured or being, you know, critiqued or being later, but in the moment of writing is the freest I ever feel, mm-hmm. Is the boldest I ever feel.
But you're also describing a sense of responsibility to get the story right, and to get the story out there, mm-hmm. first of all, and to get it right. And I'm wondering how much that has been a kind of weight.
We used to go to Haiti with college students. And one summer, we were with a group of college students, some Haitian American, some just American, and we were in a market, and they started taking pictures. And there was a woman who was sitting, sort of napping on a pile of charcoal that she was selling, and she noticed that her photograph was being taken, and then she started sort of speaking back to the students, and then she said, you know, I may seem like I'm in misery, but mes aimes c'est pas, my misery is mine, right? And she was, and you can just photograph me or telegraph it without my participation. And so that's always in my mind in the sense that, I mean, it's easier in fiction, creating the fiction, but I think in nonfiction, I always feel like, I always feel her voice is always in my mind in terms of portraying people in nonfiction.
As both an immigrant and an American, Edwige has tried in her writing to make sense of the myriad dislocations of exile. Perhaps not surprisingly, then, her feelings about current immigration policies in this country have her struggling to reconcile her childhood experiences with what her own children, and others like them, may one day have to contend with.
We're talking at a moment when there is anger crisis again among in the immigration at our borders. You've been writing about this in articles and one recent one in the New Yorker. We must not forget detained migrant children. We were talking earlier about anger. What is your feeling today?
Anger too, but also the kind of anger that moves you to act. And I think what people do not see, or especially in communities like the Haitian communities and other communities that are so deeply affected by immigration, is how long people have been also fighting this struggle. Mm-hmm. So I remember, so my parents, when I got here at age 12, used to bring me to visit people who were detained in the 1980s at a Brooklyn Navy Yard. And they were detained because Rudolph Giuliani was then Assistant Attorney General of the United States, and he went to Haiti and spoke to the dictator there then and said, and came back and said, oh, these people are okay. Baby Doc assured me that there were that there's no repression. So
see, that has some recent echoes, doesn't it?
I'm sorry. So that was happening in the 1980s, and there's been, do you know, there's been this cycle with immigration before, but I think it's reassuring also to know. I mean, we need more people doing it, but there's always been people who have been fighting these struggles over the years, and what happens is also with our notion of strangers or how we connect with people is whether or not something about them connects with us. I think when we see ourselves in the person we consider a foreigner or a stranger, this is when we're moved. So when people see children in cages, they think, oh, I have a child. That could be my child. But that child has been in that cage before. You know, we just have not seen it.
Why do you think it is happening now?
I'm grateful that there's more visibility now. I think it's the same with what we see with, you know, microaggressions with African American people. We have more ways of communicating certain things that are happening, and so there are more ways to reach people more, you know, directly, to share these stories. And there are so many stories. And I think of, you know, I think of the detained migrant children. I think of that as a symbol for this broader, all these other separations too that were happening, that the travel ban caused, that the elimination of temporary protected status, that DACA, you know, with 800,000 people in limbo, all of that also separates families. And we have to think of all these families, because people, these people just want the same kind of opportunities that my parents wanted when they made their choice to come here.
What do you tell you have two children here, not in the audience, which I asked you beforehand, so I think we can talk about them maybe?
Yes.
What do you tell them about what's happening in the country today? How do you explain it to them?
Well, we show them, my husband and I, we try to show them. So they'll go to the demonstrations with us. And actually there is a moment where, and all these people who were living in the Dominican Republic for generations were suddenly declared stateless by a ruling there that sort of echoes some of the things that are happening, that we took them to the border to see that. And so I think it's important for them to participate and to know. And actually I was reading, I'm gonna give everybody some homework, I was reading this an essay this morning in the New York Times by Elizabeth Alexander, who's a wonderful poet I loved. And then she was talking about her husband who was from died, who's an artist from Eritrea. And she says, he used to say to her, I don't want my children to be refugees, but I do want them to know what we refugees know, that you can make your life from scratch. And so that's really, I don't want them to, or their privilege, which is extraordinary compared to how I grew up, I don't want them to forget that we made our lives from scratch and that there were so many sacrifices done for it, including what John described happened to my uncle. So I never want them to forget that.
How do you do that? And how do you balance that? Because, and this is, I mean, I think everybody here is either a first or second or third or some generation of American. And as the generations go on, there's decisions in families about holding on to the past, those homelands, and then becoming more and more assimilated. Where are you at with your children? How do you keep them? How much do you want to connect them?
Well, I want to connect them as much as I can. But it's not always easy, because sometimes when I start going into one of my sob stories, my youngest goes, oh, I feel so bad for you. So I think you just, also we still have relatives who are struggling with the immigration system, and they experience it, they see it. We're not so exempt.
What about, because when we first met, there were no children in your life, right? How has that affected you as a writer, the kind of things you're writing about? For one thing, I see you've written many more children's books, right?
Yeah, one of them about immigration, Mama's Nightingale. Yeah.
So you're thinking more about reaching children, clearly.
Yeah, because I started out reading, also my first book was reading a children's book, that did have had nothing to do with my experience, but still I felt connected to. So there are some stories that I wanted to share with my children in that way. But I think one of the things that becoming a parent does too is that it sounds really sappy, but all of a sudden every child becomes your child. Like, you can see your child in almost every other child. And you can see your children and the suffering of other children. You can project, perhaps unfairly, into the joy of other children. But your heart gets so much bigger, but you have less time with to expect that bigness because you're in this wonderful endeavor that is motherhood or fatherhood.
Edwige Dandekar, thank you so much. Thank you.
Dignity isn't a particularly fashionable word these days in the realm of literature, or perhaps in any realm. But I can think of no writer who possesses more dignity than Edwige, as an artist and as a person. In everything she does, she enacts compassion through the honoring of memory and truth in her characters' lives. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Beyond the Page. To hear Edwige Dantika's unedited conversation with Jeffrey Brown, to explore the free archive of Sun Valley Writers Conference recordings, and to learn more about the conference, please visit svwc.com. I'm John Burnham Schwartz. Thanks so much for listening.
Beyond the Page is produced by John Burnham Schwartz and James Tooley. Original music by Dean Grinsfelder, and production support provided by Jay Shilliday and the Network Studios.